all experiences led by mind, made by mind, shaped by mind. With our thoughts or volitional impulses, we create our world. And all that we are, our view of ourselves, arises with our thoughts. So this is talking about a kind of patterning, isn't it? The kind of overlay upon experience. And understanding this patterning is really a present moment investigation rooted in mindfulness. Because our world of experience is truly born moment to moment. We see how this changes 1,000 times in a single day. From pessimism to hope, from fantasy to depression, to contractedness, to spaciousness, to feelings of loneliness, to feelings of connectedness. Our world of experience changes 1,000 times or more in a single day. Now, there's no emphasis in this path around doing an archaeological dig around sankharas. You know? Where did this come from? Why is it here? It is here how we are responding that is the real heart of the matter. The world arises. Are we responding with aversion, with fear, selfing? And that is here too. That is not, there's no implication that this should not be here. So how is this understood? Now this is where there is a merging, I think, of the domain of insight, which is personal insight, and the domain of insight, which is around the three characteristics of anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Huh? How is this understood, our world of experience of this moment? Through what lens, through what eyes are we actually investigating that world of experience? Clearly, there's one way of relating to that world of experience, which is, this is mine, and this is who I am, and this belongs to me. That is the way of relating to this world of experience, which is going to further and deepen the sankharas, both of ownership and the perpetuation and recreation of mental and emotional distress moment to moment. Now, it would be suggested in the world of Buddhist psychology, in the way of Buddhist understanding, that the only way, perhaps the primary way, of alleviating that distress is to change the lens through which we see this world of experience. And to begin actually to see this world of experience through the eyes of anicca, dukkha, anatta. Not as mine, but as a shaping. As a patterning. Much of the roots of that patterning were always outside of our control. It's not particularly my fault. It's not particularly my responsibility. In fact, many of the roots of that patterning we could probably never, ever even trace. But here it is arising in this moment. That is what we are concerned with. That's what sati is concerned with. That is what investigation is concerned with. How to see the eyes through which we are relating or seeing that patterning and the ways through which we are responding. Now, one way of responding, of course, is to feed the patterning. And basically, identification is a way of feeding the patterning. To say, this is me, this is self, this is who I am, this is feeding the patterning. We cannot decide just to let go. But the cultivation of the capacity for restraint is a pretty major key in beginning to starve the patterning. Restraint is always the forerunner of renunciation. This is also developmental. Restraint is not about saying this shouldn't be here, but is recognizing the primary food for patterning is thought, that thought is often the direct manifestation of identification. So it's not just any thought. It is the thoughts that actually feed what has arisen in the form of this is mine, this is here forever, this shouldn't be here. Another metta is a practice of restraint. One of the three wise intentions is actually a practice of restraint, befriending rather than judgment or aversion. Investigation is a practice of restraint. You know? What is actually going on here? Part of sati, or one of the metaphors or similes for sati, is the surgeon in relationship to a wound. The surgeon who probes the wound to actually really begin to be able to see what this is about. Who actually, in probing the wound, begins to be able to offer a diagnosis. This is identification, you know, this is aversion, this is craving. And in offering a diagnosis, offers a prognosis and a means of treatment. This is one of the similes of sati. This is what investigation is about, and it is a practice of restraint. Rather than slapping a bandage on or fearing the wound, it's actually a practice of restraint. Now, it is very, this is not an easy path, is it? And it's no more difficult now than it was 2,500 years ago. In fact, if you read the early text, it's like reading your own mind. You know, when people are coming to the Buddha and saying, you know, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know a way out of this. This is struggle. This is anguish. You know, I keep seeing it repeating and repeating over again. It's like reading your own mind. It's quite extraordinary, the timelessness of human confusion. Okay? So we don't need to feel like we invented this. And I think the Buddha was very pragmatic. You know, the Buddha was not metaphysical. Above anything else, the Buddha was a pragmatic teacher. He was concerned with what is happening and the healing of distress and understanding the ways out. So when you read the early text, you know, and then the early teachings, it's very clear in recognizing there is a tension in waking up. There is a tension in waking up. It's not that we put in a prescribed number of hours and there's some guarantee of that at the end of that. There is a tension in waking up. Because we see, you know, the gaps between our deepest values and our deepest aspirations and intentions and the sankharas, the habit patterns that so easily govern and predominate. We want to be kind, we're judgmental. We want to be spacious, we're contracted, you know. We want to be calm, we're agitated. You know, we want to be mindful, we're forgetful. This is a human story. This is a human story. We don't actually get up in the morning determining our mental state of the day. We don't get up in the morning determining our emotional reactions of the day. This is our human condition. And much of this practice is really concerned with healing that gap. This is what we mean by embodiment, but there is a tension in it. Now, the gaps make us uncomfortable, and this is okay. The gaps make us uncomfortable. You know, when we find ourselves being, you know, particularly aversive or greedy or forgetful or anxious, we do feel uncomfortable because there's a part of us that is saying, this is not what we aspire to, you know, this is not what we really wish to embody in our life. There's a way of meeting that discomfort and seeing it as a very negative tension and becoming very judgmental or ashamed or embarrassed. In my mind, this is a positive discomfort. This is like your leg waking up after it's been asleep. It's actually a sign that you're waking up, that there is discomfort there. You know, if there was no mindfulness present, no intentionality present, there would not be discomfort. So this is actually a creative discomfort. It is a discomfort in which we practice. It's wholesome. It's the virtues of what we were talking about earlier in terms of otapa or hiri. You know, it arises because we know there's something amiss. There's something awry that we're trying to align ourselves with. Now, it's very important to recognize that not all sankharas or emotional and psychological patterns are unwholesome or unskillful. It's very easy to sort of have this kind of blanket idea, you know, oh, sankharas are bad, you know, they're negative. No, of course not. Not all psychological and emotional patterning is unskillful or unhelpful. In fact, much of the practice is not focused on a mission to annihilate the unskillful. Much of the practice is focused on cultivating wholesome inner conditions, and these are sankharas. Now, when you look at the fourth foundation of mindfulness, it's essentially addressing this tension of awakening. Now, there's several different translations, you know, of the Satipatthana Sutta. And generally, what Pali scholars do is that they look at these different translations between the Pali, the Sanskrit, and the Chinese, which are the earliest teachings, and they look for congruence. You know, what is actually congruent throughout those three different translations? And you know what is congruent in the fourth foundation of mindfulness is the hindrances and the awakening factors. The rest of it is not congruent. You know, so many of you are familiar with the fourth foundation of mindfulness. You know, you see the list of the aggregates, the list of the sense doors, the Four Noble Truths. And actually, what is actually congruent is the hindrance factors and the awakening factors. And basically, this is the relationship, isn't it? This is the tension. This is the creative tension between the hindrances, which actually keep us pretty much enmeshed and enmired in confusion. And remember how the hindrance factors are actually a continuum. The five manifestations of greed, hatred, delusion, which are the three manifestations of avidya, of not knowing and not wanting to know. But the hindrance factors is what's most easily accessible and visible to us. So we see these two sitting side by side. The bhujangas, the awakening factors. Qualities that are intentional cultivations or pathways, and their fruitions are dedicated to bringing the gaps to an end. This is the tension. This is what we're working with. This is what we're practicing with, and it depends on our orientation. And I would really stress that, because I see so much the orientation in people's practice in this culture is to work on the difficult, to work on the hindrances, to work on the imperfections, to work on the issues. And I have to say, this can be indeed, it's not always, but it can be an extension of the self-narrative. You know, that I'm working on this in order to have this, to be the kind of person who has a certain kind of experience and not be the kind of person who is beset by the hindrance factors. Now, if you look at the early texts, I don't see that as being the orientation. What I see as being the orientation is actually the cultivation of the wholesome and the skillful and the liberating. Now, I just want you to consider how that is in your own practice and where your orientation is in your practice when you sit on a cushion, you know, and you meet the hindrances, you know. Does it, or you meet selfing, or you meet craving, or you meet hatred, or you meet delusion. Is the orientation of, you know, I have to work this out, you know, I have to work on this, you know, we're at the coal face, you know, we're chipping away, you know. We're chipping away at the hindrances. Or is the orientation in that moment what could be cultivated in this moment in terms of the skillful sankharas whose fruition is awakening? Now, when we look, I mean, I think this is just so important, because I think if your orientation is chipping away at the coal face, there will come a point in your practice where you will despair. And you will think, I'm not getting anywhere, you know, and this is not having any outcome, you know, and this is frustrating. Do you hear the self-narrative in that? This is about how I define myself by the imperfect. I don't want to be the kind of person who is having this kind of experience. It's one of the three forms of craving, you know? I don't want to be the kind of person who's having this kind of experience. This is the self story. I want to be this other kind of person who's having this more positive, flattering, pleasant experience. So this can be so subtle. So what the Buddha's talking about right from the first, in the get-go, is non-identification. This is the kind of experience that is arising. Doesn't say anything about who I am. This is what is arising, what is being cultivated in this moment. And as far as I can see, the inclination in the path is to move towards the bhajangas, to move towards the awakening factors as cultivations. Mindfulness is the beginning. The beginning of ending avidya, because mindfulness wants to know. If you can undercut that aspect of avidya that just doesn't want to know what's going on, you're a long way along the path. So mindfulness is the first response to avidya, because mindfulness is wanting to know. It's turning towards, rather than turning away from or being forgetful or neglecting. It is beginning to undo avidya. It is the first step. Mindfulness is so interwoven then with investigation. And investigation is what is bringing in the three characteristics. To actually begin to see the nature of this experience that is happening. Well, it is impermanent. It is fluctuating. It is changing. It is not constant. To begin actually to see that. To know, to lose the enchantment with it. It is unsatisfactory. You know, no matter how much that kind of construction feels pleasant, it's unsatisfactory, and it is not self. It is not self. That which can be seen is not who I am. That which can be turned into the object of mindfulness, of sati, is not who I am. Investigation is interwoven with virya, but it is also, virya is one of the outcomes of interest. I mean, this is obvious in very mundane levels in our life. You know, when we're interested in something, there's energy. When we're not interested in something, there's no energy. But virya has a different aspect, because virya is actually translated as heroism, not just as energy. It is translated as heroism and as courage, because it is swimming against the tide. It's swimming against the current. It's swimming against that automatic reactivity. And it's swimming against some of those sankharas, as you mentioned, of fear. And it takes enormous courage, actually, to begin to move into territories that are unknown. So virya is, as one of the bhajanga awakening factors, is more than just getting up in the morning and feeling full of zip. It's actually rooted in investigation and having that willingness to actually swim again what feels easiest. You know, and greed, hatred, and delusion certainly at times feel easiest because they're most familiar. But they're certainly hardest in terms of their impact upon well-being. Joy is one of the bhajanga factors. It is essential in this path of awakening. You know, it can often feel to be so lacking in people's practice, particularly when we're at the coal face. You know, there's not a lot of joy at the coal face. You know, because it feels endless, you know. And joy, piti, there is so many dimensions of it. But joy is so essential in this practice, the delighting in awareness, you know? The delighting in actually being present, the delighting in seeing, the delighting in seeing things begin to fall away, the actual delight in contentment, you know, in stillness, in quietude, to actually delight in that rather than something very different than momentary pleasures. And this is an attitudinal commitment, by the way. Joy doesn't come about, you know, because you've chipped enough away at the coal face. Joy is an attitudinal commitment, and you don't contrive joy, but you certainly make room for it. You certainly make room for it. And we make room for a lot of joy when we actually really have that kind of virya and that mindfulness that allows us to step out of the preoccupations and just see wholeheartedly and listen wholeheartedly and actually embrace the fullness of this moment. You know, there comes a little bit of joy. You know, if a colleague of mine refers to so many people's attitudes and practices, you know, resembling that kind of march to the scaffold. You know, kind of marching along, you know, to the gallows. This is not a good foundation for being able to sustain practice. But we make room for joy. Tranquility. It's one of the Bhojanga factors. This is a practice of immediacy, calming the formations. We're going right back to the beginning of the Satipatthana. Breathing in, calming the formations. Breathing out, calming the formations. Taking a step, calming the formations. Being present, calming the formations. Concentration is part of this. You know, concentration is the muscle of sati. You know, and sati needs a bit of muscle. It's not just a kind of, just be mindful. It actually needs a little bit of concentration. It needs a little bit of muscle to sustain sati. For some people, it's really the Achilles heel in their practice. And when we talk about concentration, you know, we're not talking about eighth jhana necessarily. You know, we're talking about our capacity to practice wholeheartedness moment to moment, which is renouncing the practice of distractedness. Renouncing the practice of distractedness. And we have a lot of opportunities to do that. You know, do we drive the car while talking on our cell phone? You know, all the moments where we might be practicing fragmented attention in a day are probably all the moments where actually we could be practicing one-pointedness. And this is so helpful to us, you know. It is what allows mindfulness to really have that kind of strength and resilience. And equanimity, you know, and talking about this capacity, there's so many dimensions of equanimity, from the sense of balance within the winds of life to actually what we were talking about yesterday, not being fooled by the signs that perception delivers. Not being deceived by the signifiers that arise, that are placing upon the world this power to deliver happiness and unhappiness, not being deceived by the signifiers that come through perception, which are making everything personal to us. The way that everything becomes personal to us. Now, my sense of cultivating these qualities moment to moment is a direct antidote to avidya and its manifestations in greed, hatred, and delusion, and its manifestation in the hindrances. Now, when the bhajangas are present, craving and aversion find no foothold. Craving and aversion find no foothold. They dissolve. The bhajangas dissolve the asavas, the unskillful sankharas. Now, the bhajangas are the awakening factors. These are not accidents. They are conscious cultivations. They are attitudinal commitments. They are moment-to-moment cultivations, and their fruition is actually nibbana. You know, the Buddha was very clear in this. The fruition is nibbana. In fact, nibbana is often described as the realized bhajangas, the embodied bhajangas. So we start with mindfulness, because sati does give us a choice about what we are feeding and practicing moment to moment. And to recognize that there are choices, and that's a tremendous freedom in this life, to know that there is a choice about what we feed and about what we practice. Enormous freedom. And it, you know, having that choice is really a practice of awakening the moment, liberating the moment. They are the practices of happiness. And I think in the light of those practices, you know, this is where embodiment starts to happen, where we're embodying the aspirations and the values and the intentions that we do most deeply value. And that is it. That is it. So we have just a few moments if there's anything that you want to raise or question. Yeah.
Yesterday you said in passing, and maybe you put in too much emphasis on it, thinking about it, that discipline is a kindness. And I wondered how you would distinguish how you're thinking of discipline as opposed to renunciation.
This is all part of the same fabric, but I think originally the word discipline comes from the word to love, to follow. I mean, we have a particular distortion of discipline, you know, as a should or as a must. But I think discipline actually does come from that root, and that has so much to do with, you know, the attitudinal commitments of the moment, where we are hanging our hat, you know, what we are setting our heart upon. You know, and to do that involves all of the other factors, doesn't it, of restraint and not feeding what we don't actually love or feel that it's wise to follow. And that is a forerunner to renunciation. Yes,
sorry.
Yes, but don't dismiss that part, okay? I mean, there's a lot of value that is given to this teaching to learning to reflect upon the teaching. This is involving our intellect, you know? Learning to contemplate the teaching. Learning to reflect upon our experience. I mean, sadly, in many people's education, you know, we've been taught to memorize, we've been taught to learn, but we haven't always been taught so well how to reflect, you know? We're much better at obsession than reflection. So I don't want to dismiss the intellectual component, because, you know, we are intellectual beings as well as we are emotional beings. You know, this is part of the fabric of our being, and it's more learning to use that capacity skillfully rather than it always being kind of prone to move into obsession. And I think that's a whole exercise in itself, you know? To take something, you know, a question like, what does non-self mean to me? And to sit with that question and to see what arises and to see where it might start to slide into repetition or obsession and to be able to put it down. But then not to think of that as a failure, to think about it as a training, you know, that we might then pick it up again and actually sit exactly with the same question and see what arises. You know, so really to include that part of investigation, which is reflective, it involves thinking, because this practice is not anti-thought. It really questions the unskillful use of thought and how it can lead to distress, but also recognizes the great value of skillful use of thought in terms of creativity, in terms of our capacity for empathy, imagining, in terms of reflection. So, you know, we're actually learning to develop that. So that's one aspect of investigation. And the other aspect of investigation is more within the realm of experiential investigation. And in my understanding, the whole of meditative practice is experiential investigation. You know, for example, if you sit and there's a sensation in your knee that arises, and you have the willingness to go past that first flinch moment to just see what unfolds, that's experiential investigation, isn't it? You sit and you might say a very familiar sankhara arising of self-judgment, and you might say, oh, in this moment actually I could come back to being more embodied, or I could cultivate some metta. That's experiential investigation. It's really exploring what might unfold when we go past those familiar places of reactivity. When we sit and we commit to developing, you know, a greater one-pointedness, that's experiential investigation. So both of these elements are very much interwoven, and they're very much coming together, and they're both incredibly valuable in the path.